It's a real honor to welcome returning Value Conferences instructors Travis Koch and John Hook of Voss Capital joining us for Best Ideas 2017. John and Travis had a remarkable idea at last year's Best Ideas 2016 conference, QHR, which I hope we might touch on a bit as a postmortem. The idea they have prepared for today is also quite wonderful. It's a pleasure to welcome Travis and John. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Shai. Thanks to the Manual of Ideas and Value Conferences for having us back. Always a pleasure. And I'm going to jump right in here. Just a quick background on Voss Capital. We generally target sort of smaller, underfollowed special situations. The median market cap on the long side for us is about 400 to 450 million. We're typically holding 30 longs, 15 shorts. I'm weighting those top 10 core size positions about 5 to 7%. So if you look at only the long portion of our book, we've done a 29% CAGR since inception, overall about a 20% net with 40% net exposure and pretty low correlation. So as Shai mentioned, we got pretty lucky pitching QHR last year. We felt that it really was representative of all the business model characteristics in a special situation that we're looking for on the long side. And so it played out about as well as you could hope for. But a quick annotated stock chart here of sort of the events as they happened and played out. And then we pitched it in early January. The stock was about $1.25. Ended up subsequently getting a buyout offer from Loblaws at $3.10 the first week of August. And really the key to that was what we call the Voss sauce. That's a software company that does an asset divestiture, becomes a pure play, sees accelerating growth and expanding margins. So with that as background, I'll jump straight into our pick this year. And the pick is PAR Technology. It's a long, we think, with about 100% upside in our base case. Some of the basics, they've got a market cap and enterprise value, both around $90 million, and the stock price is right around $5.50. A quick executive summary. PAR hits a lot of our investment checkboxes. It's underfollowed. There is no sell-side analyst, really little buy-side write-up exposure or coverage. They're cash flow positive. Valuation is depressed for reasons that we think are explainable and that we can identify. And they're an industry leader in their core business, which is restaurant point of sales. So it's a multi-segment business, and this really comes straight out of the Manual of Ideas in Chapter 7, the book, about special situations with an underperforming segment, and a special situation being defined as having really no correlation to overall equities or not being driven by equity beta over the next sort of 12 to 18 months. So we'll go through some of these reasons why PAR stock is depressed, to touch briefly on new management, what they're doing to unlock value, and then we'll talk about the valuation and on a sum of the parts basis. Quickly, let's step back and visit what PAR is. It's two completely disparate businesses, which makes screening makes it a bad doesn't show up on screens very well. Doesn't really have pure play trading comps, and it's kind of in no man's land. But we think that will change the second half of this year. So the first segment is PAR Hospitality. This is software, hardware, and services to restaurants. That's about 63% of revenues and 33% of EBITDA. And then there's PAR Government, which is outsourced labor and some software development for various government agencies. So why is valuation depressed? Well, they've had lackluster operating results the last few years. Revenue and gross profit have not recovered from 2008 peak levels. They were not EBIT positive from 2012 to 2014. There's a lot of one-time noise and the financials are messy. Margins in the core hardware business have declined. And this makes up a large proportion, so it's masking improvement in these other segments that are quick, fast-growing, have expanding margins. Like I mentioned, there's probably a sum of the parts discount due to the collection of businesses being completely unrelated. There's not really a coherent investment narrative at this point, and it's pretty underfollowed and rather illiquid, trading about 100,000 shares a day. There are big blocks that have been trading recently. There's been a long-term shareholder that's been liquidating. And then lastly, another reason is a revolving door at the C-suite level. Some issues with the previous CFO being caught with unauthorized investments. And then also a disclosure of a material internal control weakness that was qualitative in nature in the Chinese office that only affected about 4 million of total sales. Just to elaborate very quickly on the background, this just shows a chart of gross profit and EBITDA over time, over the last 10 years, and you can see that EBITDA has declined by about 20%. You know, we think a lot of investors are just fatigued after continual disappointment for years and years and years, and now things are finally changing. And again, the government segment has low gross margins, as low as about 7.9%, and this is masking really the attractiveness of the overall business. Just for those investors who might be growth or tech investors and they're just looking superficially, they'll just kind of take a look at this and then shrug it off and move on. But they're missing something kind of going on underneath the surface. With that, I'll turn it over to John to talk about how they're going to transition into a pure play.
Thanks, Travis. So a primary part of our thesis for PARS is they're going to go down a path of becoming a pure play to unlock value. And as you can see here, in September of 2015, the company not only had their government and hospitality business, they also had multiple businesses within hospitality, some of which were losing money. Next slide. In November of 2015, they divested their Springer Miller hospitality software business, which was losing $3 million a year. This was sold for $18 million to Constellation Software, and they sold a guaranteed receivable coming in June 2017 for at least $4.5 million. So that was the first step they took in simplifying the company. As you can see here, the chart below shows EBITDA minus CapEx, one proxy we use for cash flow. It's broken down by the hospitality segment before selling Springer Miller, which is in the gray area, and after, which is in the blue area. As you can see, the profitability improved materially and recently went positive, and something we expect to continue in the future. Based on the recent quarter, which was strong, they're at about a 7.2 million run rate on their EBITDA, and that's something we expect to continue to improve upon throughout 2017. Since selling Springer Miller, management has also talked about the possibility of selling the government business in mid to late 2017 after they finished their company-wide ERP implementation. Although they have yet to formally announce selling this division, reading between the lines, we believe the clear intention is to do just that. And it's really now that you want to start accumulating the shares before such an announcement is made. As we're going to detail later, selling this government business, even at conservative multiples, will create a cash-rich, growing technology pure play company with two major growth assets, Brink and SureCheck, and considerable opportunity to improve margins quickly. The table here details what we think PAR will roughly look like on a pro forma basis after they sell the government business. At its current price, the enterprise value would decline to about $38 million, and the remaining hospitality business would be trading at about 0.25 times sales, under 1 times gross profit, and 6.4 times EBITDA, incidentally under 4 times our 2018 EBITDA. As we're going to show later in the valuation section, no matter how you slice it, this is going to make PAR look egregiously cheap, even if it wasn't growing and wasn't profitable. We believe, though, that the growth can accelerate and the quality of that revenue, mostly software, will materially drive margins higher as well.
So,
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Before diving into the core of our thesis around Brink and the hospitality section, we thought it would be good to first look at the value of the other business, PAR Government. As we touched on, there are two sections in PAR Government, Mission Systems and Intel Solutions. Mission Systems is literally taking over specific operations of telecom and other facilities that are traditionally run by the government. It's not high-tech work, and as we understand it, PAR has dozens of years of experience running these things and is trusted by the government to do so. It generates about a 5-6% pre-tax margin and virtually has no CapEx. They compete with the Booz Allen, Hamiltons, and the Raytheons and Boeings of the world. Although PAR doesn't break out the financial performance between Mission Systems and Intel Solutions, we believe Mission Systems is more or less flat on a revenue growth basis or maybe slightly declining. The other half of the government business is Intel Solutions. It's once again outsourced labor for the Department of Defense. But in this case, it's much higher knowledge level, like PhD-type workers who are highly trained as coders. Most of the projects are classified, so we don't have great specific examples of what they do. But as we understand it, it's mostly geomapping software and generating real-time motion video from satellites. So an example I think of is the type of software Google is building for their self-driving cars. Given the high talent required, it does generate higher margins in the 8 to 10% pre-tax range, and once again, has virtually no CapEx. It competes with other business service IT companies like SEIC, NCI, Mantech, and others. Given the overall margin composition of the government business, we believe this business is growing, albeit slowly, in the low single-digit range. For a contract low-margin business, PARC Government is surprisingly consistent as a cash flow generator. You can see on the chart here, the overall pre-tax margins have been slightly rising over time, resulting in a slow but steady rise from about $1 million a quarter in pre-tax income to $1.4 million more recently. In the last quarter, the revenue grew 5% and EBIT grew about 8%. But overall, it's a pretty consistent business, and management has even called it an annuity business. We believe the slow, steady growth can continue for this business given the recent spike in the backlog. In Q2, the backlog jumped substantially, about 50% sequentially, and in Q3, it was 25% higher year over year. We believe it can do about $90 million in revenue in 2017 and can do about $6 million in pre-tax income. So what is PARC Government worth? Management has commented that they want to wait until they complete the company-wide ERP solution before they sell the government business. Although this might sound counterintuitive, the reason they're doing this is they are able to bill the government for a small piece of the ERP implementation as part of the contract. After they complete the ERP implementation, we believe they will turn focus to exploring a sale of this business. Not only have they expressed openness to this idea, they're getting heavy pressure from their largest shareholders to break up the company and become a pure play. So it is part of our thesis that this gets done near the end of 2017 or early 2018. It leads to the question of what it might be worth. Looking at the comp table below, the median comp trades at 1x sales and about 14 times forward EBIT. PAR's EBIT margin and growth rates stand up reasonably well to the comp group, but we believe they would sell at the lower end of the range given their lack of intellectual property, which some of the other companies maintain. In other words, PAR Government has no technology to sell. It's basically just its decades long of brand recognition of quality and human resources that an acquirer would take over. Also, since there's very little operating costs and CapEx, there isn't likely to be a lot of synergies. Nevertheless, we think this business should sell for no less than 7x EBIT, which would be about $42 million or under 0.5x sales. These would both be below the minimum comp NCI, which is negative growth and lower EBIT margins. PAR has asked consultants to value the government business, and from our understanding, they came in at around $40 million, but that was back in mid-2015. Since then, in the entire space, as shown by the chart below, or chart on the slide, has re-rated nearly 40% from about 11x forward EBIT to 14x forward EBIT. Thus, we're quite comfortable that the gross proceeds will equal at least $40 million and could potentially be material higher. If an acquirer was willing to pay 10x EBIT, still a substantial discount to the group and potentially accretive to the acquirer, it would be $60 million, which would cover two-thirds of the company's current EV. The net proceeds from a government sale depend on the cost basis and the NOLs they might be able to utilize, so there may be some tax leakage, but we assume in our analysis they will pay around a 15% tax rate net on a sale. And Travis?
Yeah, so turning our attention to what will remain after the government business is sold would be the segment PAR Hospitality, which is really divided up into three main revenue components. 65% of revenue is hardware. Within that 65%, about 50% of that is proprietary, the point of sale system terminals. So you walk up to McDonald's and they're touching doing the touch screen behind the cash register, hitting the no onions button on your Big Mac. PAR manufactures that hardware and gets about between 30 to 40% gross margin on that. In addition, they'll sell some peripheral hardware, such as some monitors that go in the back of the kitchen, receipt printers, et cetera. This is all third-party reselling. It's lower gross margin, almost break-even, about 5% gross margin, and that's about half of sales within hardware. Secondly, software is currently about 10% of revenues, but is growing materially. This is made up of the SaaS POS software product, the real gem of the business called Brink. a call option on the called SureCheck, which is a food safety cloud product. And then lastly, PixelPoint, which is the legacy on-premise software product, mostly deployed internationally, have a couple of tier ones internationally, and then Baskin-Robbins is sort of their biggest customer domestically. And then the third revenue segment is services. This comes directly from the sale of hardware through maintenance contracts and along with some implementation and training. This makes up about 25% of revenue, is growing pretty slowly, about, I believe, 8% in the latest quarter. So for more background on the hardware business, Faro has been in the point-of-sale hardware business for almost 40 years now. They've got sales in 110 countries, a lot of Tier 1 client wins. McDonald's and Yum are the greatest percentage of their greatest customer concentration. They're installed in 75,000 restaurants globally. They have the most market share tier one QSRs domestically, and there's a picture of their product there. What they're known for, the EverServe. Just to frame the opportunity here, we listed out only tier one QSRs just in the United States, and tier one is defined as 2,000 units or just under 2,000. And then we've listed on the right column here if they're an existing PAR customer or not. So there's about 240,000 QSR locations. That's just the tier one. There's a lot of other tier two, tier three, tier four, with even, 240,000 total. In the top 20, about 127,000. So that underscores sort of just how large the industry is within the United States, and then how PAR sort of dominates it on the hardware side. Looking back over time, you can see that hardware revenues have essentially been flat since 2008, with a downtrend in gross margins. Gross margins have deteriorated from about mid-30s to 25%, and then ticked up pretty meaningfully in this latest quarter sequentially. This is generally cyclical, but there's also a replacement, a steady replacement demand here. So the average shelf life or useful life of the hardware within the restaurant tends to be about 6 to 8 years. So we think about 1/7 of the entire existing install base is needing to replace their hardware on an annual basis. To understand how the hardware business works, we've broken it down into the unit economics of just selling one single McDonald's location. So you can see here, a McDonald's would have between 6 and 8 POS terminals for a total cost of $25,000 to $30,000. Those would be the EverServe at about 40% gross margins. About 50% of that $30,000 would be, again, the third-party hardware, the monitors and the receipt printers at a lower gross margin. On top of the hardware purchase, they will get an implementation and training charge, typically 5 to 10% of the total hardware cost. That implementation is done very quickly, and training, given that there's high turnover in the QSR space, a new employee can be trained in under 1 hour. And then lastly, there's a maintenance component running at about an average of $1,500 per store per year, and this is contractual. The go-to-market strategy is that PAR will negotiate with the corporate or the franchisor and then get what we would call a hunting license to go out and sell into the franchise base, or the franchisor will push PAR as a vendor onto their franchise base. Adding this all up, the total hardware from one McDonald's location would be about $33,000, along with that $1,500 a year recurring maintenance piece. Here we're showing McDonald's and Yum as a percentage of total PAR revenue over time. And what you can see is that McDonald's spiked back in 2010, right after the EverServe 6000 series was released. There was another iteration of the product released in 2012, but they did not see the uptick. And we think the reason for that is, again, it's this replacement cycle that I'm talking about, sort of every 7 or 8 years. And the latest iteration of the hardware has just been approved by McDonald's, and all of the stores are in an upgrade cycle that's just kind of seeing an uptick that we think will last into 2017. to back up this commentary on the McDonald's uptake, we pulled a couple of quotes here from the CEO on the Q2 call and then again on the Q3 call, just talking about how McDonald's will see a significant uptake and that they expect this trend to continue. Next, on the hardware maintenance piece, this is tied to the existing hardware install base, and PAR generates $26 million a year, which is that is the recurring hardware maintenance contracts on an annual basis. Again, this is consistent, it's low growth, relatively low margin, but in our ultimate sum of the parts, which we'll walk through at the end, we are valuing this contractual revenue at 1.25 times sales or 4 times gross profit, and this little piece of revenue alone could be worth $34 million relative to the EV of close to 90. Part of our thesis on this hardware going forward is that we're not baking in our base case growth or an expansion in margins. However, we think there are a couple of positive factors that are being overlooked. Number one, again, is this McDonald's upgrade cycle. McDonald's has more proprietary hardware as a mix because they've got more terminals per store. So that can boost gross margins. Secondly, Brink and SureCheck are both growing quickly and becoming a bigger percentage of total sales, and the hardware pull-through on a Brink sale is higher than the company average, and then SureTech devices have a higher than company average on the gross margins. And then lastly, the company is going implementing the ERP, as John mentioned, and is going doing some reshorings for some final assembly in upstate New York, which I think will release working capital, help with inventory management, and can also improve margins. So again, our base case is sort of slow to flat growth and flat margins, but there is reason to believe that could tick upwards. With that, I'll turn it back to John to discuss the software aspect.
All right. Yeah, so thanks, Travis. The moment you've been waiting for the people who stuck with us here. We believe the crux of the upside in the company in PAR is their emerging software assets, and that's specifically Brink and SureCheck. Just touching quickly on the third one, PixelPoint. PixelPoint was purchased in 2005, but they kind of botched their go-to-market strategy by not initially having a formal maintenance model like every other software company. They did adopt maintenance later on, but it's still a pretty low percentage of the revenues. At this point, we believe PixelPoint does about $6 million a year in licenses and maintenance, not growing, but high margin. So it's worth something, but it's not being emphasized by the company. We believe ultimately the plan is that for Brink to take over PixelPoint customers, including their largest customer, Baskin-Robbins. PixelPoint, by the way, is just the on-premise POS solution as opposed to Brink, which is a cloud-based solution. Next slide. Moving on to Brink, which is really has the most significant visible call optionality. A little background on Brink. They were founded in 2008. And they were always built as a pure software as a service or SaaS product for the quick service restaurant industry. PAR bought them for $17 million. Seven of that is contingent upon aggressive earnout growth targets. So they only paid $10 million up front. When they bought them, Brink had about 400 restaurant installations live. And we believe that the current CEO, Karen Salmon, was the one who evangelized this acquisition and was the one who ultimately pulled the trigger on it. They have a typical SaaS business model. They want to sell everything for a monthly subscription fee. Right now, we believe the ARPU per store per month nets out at about $150, although it's our understanding this can rise materially over time as the company works to cross-sell other modules and as they move up market. The monthly cost is partly based on the number of terminals the restaurant has, so larger chains buying the software would typically have a higher ARPU, even if there is some discounting for the larger chains. Looking at the competitive landscape, Brink competes with both giants and ankle biters that are VC-funded, so we would characterize the competitive environment as strong or intense. At the top, they compete with Oracle, who purchased Micros a few years ago. Micros was one of the dominant POS players in the market and broadly sold POS solutions to really all walks of retail and hospitality. Oracle has a cloud platform called Symphony that PAR competes with. Similarly, NCR purchased Radiant Systems, which is another strong POS pure play. NCR has an iOS cloud product, or Apple cloud product, called Silver, plus they have their on-site POS product that is Microsoft-based. These two companies are tough competitors, and they're going to be most competitive with PAR for the giant, larger restaurant Tier 1 deals as they thrive on customization that Tier 1 might want in their product. At the bottom of the spectrum are Toast and Revel, which are VC-funded upstarts that have started by selling to mom-and-pop 1 to 10 restaurant concept stores. We don't know exactly their revenue information about either of them, but we do know that Revel was valued at over $500 million recently in a financing round. We also know that Revel is more broad-based than QSR restaurants, as they have companies like Goodwill and Shell Gas as customers. Toast probably most directly targets the same customer set as PAR, i.e., QSR restaurants, although Toast works off the Android operating system, which some in the industry we've talked to view as problematic, especially when targeting organizations with significantly larger size who are used to Microsoft or Apple. Ultimately, we believe PAR fills a unique role in the market for tier two and tier three level restaurants with some scale that want a relatively affordable solution and a hardware partner with a lot of experience. To come up with our list of competitive differentiations for Brink, we went to the Food Safety Tech Conference in Dallas in fall of 2016, and we basically asked as many people at the conference about Brink as possible. The reaction we got was universally positive on Brink as a product. For instance, we talked to the head of IT at Five Guys Burgers, who said that Brink was best in class and was iterating the product rapidly. We talked to an independent restaurant consultant who specializes in turnarounds, who told us Brink was the hot POS and that their biggest issue was handling all the RFPs. We also talked to some third-party specialists who said Brink plays best with other third-party vendors. One of the Brink co-founders told us they generate significant business just from third-party vendors who recommend Brink to their customers. Speaking to this co-founder, who's Paul Rubin, we also got the sense that he knew his stuff and would be a good evangelist for Brink. He spoke in front of a packed house at the conference and generated numerous questions from a variety of stores at his session. For instance, he got questions from IT vendors at Red Lobster and TGI Fridays, companies that were not in the QSR sphere but are more table service-based. Overall, on the weakness side, we believe the biggest weakness Brink has is it tries to land large international customers is that it's only English compatible currently. This is where emerging Pixel Point's development team is designed to help, as Pixel Point, the legacy POS, strength is in the international compatibility department. The other weakness that Paul Rubin cited himself is that they still have some product holes to fill regarding dealing with fine dining and table service restaurants. And he did mention that they are a bit more expensive than Revel and Toast and some of the other smaller startups.
Hey, John, I was just going to add, a lot of the Tier 1 QSRs treat international markets as completely separate, so even the lack of certain foreign language and the regulation compliance is not going to prevent them from getting Tier 1s domestically. So, for example, Five Guys, they got Five Guys, all the Five Guys stores domestically, but they're still an international concept with stores all over the world, so... I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah,
and then,
that's a good point. Yeah, it's not like they can't sign a tier one vendor, like a Dairy Queen or something, and then launch. You know, they can launch it domestically, and then later they can try and launch internationally. It's a different sales process. Okay, so despite hearing all these good things about Brink, we would normally still be pretty skeptical about its ability to generate business. But the progress they've made at landing deals since it was purchased reinforces our view that it's legitimately becoming a real player in the software POS space. As we mentioned, when they bought it in Q3 of 2014, it had 400 units, but it's since expanded its active base of restaurants to over 2,000 in the most recent quarter and guided to nearly 2,500 by the end of the year. That's sustained 120% growth over a two-year period, and it's starting to become a more material impact to PAR. By the end of this year, we believe their software revenue run rate, or ARR, will be around $4.4 million, up from a disclosed $3.6 million at the end of Q3. Perhaps more impressive is the signed backlog they have awaiting implementation. In Q3, the signed backlog rose 50% sequentially to $9 million. That's signed but unimplemented annual recurring revenue. The company has targeted doubling their base again to 5,000 units by the end of 2017, based on the backlog, this seems quite achievable. On the last call, they actually gave us a lot more details about their overall pipeline in addition to the signed backlog. If we start with the overall U.S. QSR TAM of about 240,000 QSR restaurants. Brink claims to be in discussion with over 20,000 sites, so going through the RFP process. And this includes 3 to 4 tier one restaurant vendors that they're having active discussion with. Moving down the funnel a little bit, they're in lab or pilot with restaurants that have a base of at least 11,000 sites. And this is, we believe, is at least one large tier one vendor and perhaps two. And they hope to land that formally in 2017. So taking all that info together, so the info received on product quality and technical leadership, penetration, growth of the install base to date, and the gigantic backlog and the pipeline, that we were kind of able to form our four theses around Brink going forward. First, our thesis one is that it's a wide open market. Almost zero large chains have moved to a cloud platform, and nearly all of them will over the next 5 years. It's very early innings. Second, Brink is a product quality leader, which we discussed. After speaking with the co-founder, Paul Rubin, we believe they're winning deals at a pretty high percentage, 70% plus, over Oracle and NCR, and are displacing Revel and Toast in many instances. Rubin claims that they've never had a competitive displacement, and that all churn is from stores going out of business or downsizing their operations. Churn is about 2%, they say. Third, there's unusual growth visibility for a smaller software product. In addition to the large backlog, we know that Brink's current largest customer, Five Guys, will have all of their stores on Brink by the end of 2017. So that's 900 units that have yet to be implemented just on Five Guys in 2017. Finally, we believe Brink will land at least one and probably two Tier 1 contracts in 2017, with potentially more to follow in 2018. So until this actually happens, it's going to remain a pure prediction. But we think there is weight to that prediction, given the CEO and Paul Rubin's commentary, their successful move-up market to chains like Five Guys, and maybe most importantly, their vast hardware experience, 40-plus years in industry relations. Nothing is guaranteed, but we think it's a reasonable bet that they land whales sooner rather than later. The CEO has set a target of 10,000 units to be installed by the end of 2018 and claims this is potentially conservative, as it does not assume any Tier 1 wins. With 10,000 units, the company could have $20 million in low churn, high margin recurring revenue that has shown 4 consecutive years of 100% unit and revenue growth. We believe this would easily cover the entire current EV of PAR. In addition, we believe Brink will kind of lift the tide on all boats. It will significantly buffer and provide some margin of safety to the hardware business. We're told that Brink has an 80% hardware attach rate and that hardware margins are higher for Brink. Rubin explained to us that generally when the hardware is bought because of the software, the customer doesn't negotiate as hard for the hardware and the margins are higher. Just last quarter, what they describe as Brink pull-through hardware revenue was 10% of total hardware revenue. We estimate it'll be about 20% by the end of 2017. They also noted that Brink associated revenue had grown 178% year over year. So that includes not only the hardware, the software, but also implementation and hardware maintenance revenues. The CEO, Karen, estimated that for every $1 of SaaS revenues the company generates through Brink, it generates another $3 or $4 of hardware and service revenue. Thus, if and when Brink hits $20 million in SaaS revenues, it may be adding $60 to $70 million of additional hardware and services revenue, which would be very material to the hardware business. To illustrate, just kind of hammer the point home a little further, we put together a hypothetical of various possible customers and what they could generate in the United States alone. Just their existing base plus 3 tier one wins like Dairy Queen, Arby's, and KFC would be worth almost $42 million in annual recurring revenue. In our minds, given the growth and underlying margins of the business, it would command a revenue multiple of 6 to 7 times, making Brink SaaS revenues on its own worth $240 to $280 million, 3 times the current EV. We're a little hesitant to say, but wait, there's more, but we do think there is a truly blue sky scenario where there could be a lot more. For instance, while the ARPU is 150 now, management believes they can increase it to 190 to 200 over time as they cross-sell and move up market. Second, they have large international ambitions, including the international stores with tier ones they sign in the U.S. It's obviously another vast market, and they have experience working in the on the hardware side. Third, they aspire to land McDonald's and think they have a real chance of getting McDonald's, given the 40 years of relationship they've built with them. As we understand it, McDonald's currently does their POS in-house, and they spend a small fortune maintaining it. Finally, as mentioned, they can expand outside of the QSR space where we believe there's already preliminary interest in the product, so table service, et cetera, et cetera. We don't model any of this through 2019, but we believe if execution is strong and some of the catalysts could occur over time. We currently ascribe value of $50 million to Brink, which is 8 times our 2017 sales numbers, which we think is fair given the high sustained growth trajectory and visibility into future growth. Travis?
Okay, so moving on to another potential growth driver, SureCheck. The management is pretty optimistic about this, especially their tone seems to be getting more optimistic in the last few months. But we really don't model much growth here whatsoever, so we're kind of framing it as a free call option at this point. SureCheck is a player in digital documentation of food preparation practices and food safety in general. So the revenue is a mix of car-designed custom hardware and the SaaS software that is tied to that product. It was originally built for Walmart when Walmart was being sued over a food safety issue back in 2012. Walmart came to PAR. The original contract was for $5 million, along with $500,000 of annual hosting cost reimbursement. So PAR really doesn't make money on the Walmart contract, but they serve as a good reference customer and hopefully can help them land some other big whales. I was in Whole Foods Hot Bar not too long ago, and I saw a lady walking around with a little laser shining it into the soups and then recording on pen and paper the temperature of the soups. So you can see the little probe on the SureCheck device with the blue cord going there. They also have the laser version, the infrared, to check the temperature. But that's an example of a use case where Whole Foods could go in there, point this device at the soup, and then it automatically logs when they checked it, sends it up to the cloud, keeps a digital record. It's a great cheap option just to cover their butts. So there's a little bit of a stick and a carrot approach here to adopting SureCheck as a food safety device for these various food retailers. The carrot side is simply, for example, Wegmans claims that SureCheck pays for itself every single month purely through paper cost savings and printing and ink and whatnot. Secondly, there's a stick as an incentive, and that is in September, the Food Safety Modernization Act was implemented. That's very recent. So any company selling greater than 100 million, or sorry, 1 million of food sales has to have a food safety plan and retain 2 years of record. They're subject to random inspections, et cetera. You can imagine how this might play out and help in a court situation or an investigation with the Chipotles and the Bluebells of the world. On the hardware, there are two options. The cheaper temperature measuring device for $400. This is what Walmart has in every single store. And then there's the SureCheck Advantage, which is more expensive, $1,500 per device. And this is what Wegmans and all new customers will be buying. So they're getting this, again, has higher gross margin average than PAR's hardware business overall. So they're transitioning the business model. Again, they're not really getting anything recurring from Walmart and Wegmans, just the cloud hosting costs. But going forward, they will have a SaaS model. So the customers will buy the hardware, they'll get that upfront cost, and then they'll pay $45 to $55 per month per device. And using a Walmart store as an example, there's 4 devices per store on average. So this would be $200 per store per month. Giving an individual example, a hypothetical of what one big customer could do, what that would look like in terms of impact on the financials. We took Kroger here, 2,400 stores, 4 devices per store. So we've got that would equal about $14 million in one-time hardware revenue and then a $5.1 million in recurring annual subscription revenue, which again is high margin, recurring, could be growing quickly and should get a pretty decent sales multiple. In the competitive landscape, a little bit more of a greenfield opportunity, pretty unclouded at this point. Management sites, just paper records keeping as being the biggest competitor. The most direct competitor we can find is called iCertainty, where one of SureCheck's sales guys just came over from that company that we met with. Another one is Safety Chain, and then a public company, Digi International. So you can look at that just for a trading comp or to get a sense of the landscape. Right now, adoption is slow, but management, again, is optimistic. Lastly, I want to point out that this is not a direct competitor, but just to give everyone a sense of the excitement and really hype around the food safety industry, you can take a look at Park City Group, PCYG, and then check the appendix in the presentation where we have a couple of slides laying out a short thesis on Park City, and we're using that as a short to hedge the SureCheck exposure in our long par trade. I'm going to throw back to John here to kind of walk through gross profit estimate breakdown of pulling it all together here for all of the par hospitality pieces.
Thanks, Travis. So this is a little bit in the weeds, so I'll just make a couple points on it. So the slide attempts to quantify how we're deriving gross profit numbers from 2016 to 2019. And if you look at the Brink line in revenue and then the Brink line for gross margins, you can see that that's going to be the biggest incremental boost as we move from about $40 million in gross profit dollars to $60 million in gross profit dollars. There's also some movement from SureCheck and a little bit from the proprietary hardware side, but a bulk of our assumed growth is coming from Brink. And we think this could be conservative in a number of ways, but we think it's a relatively conservative base case of growing your gross profit dollars from $40 million to $60 million over a couple-year period. And so now let's talk about how we're thinking about a framework for valuing par hospitality in particular, removing the government from the equation for the moment. So so based on the assumed government transaction, the table below is showing PAR's pro forma ex-government multiple, which is essentially around 0.25 times sales, 1 times gross profit, and 6 times EBITDA. This is assuming that they sell the government business for 7 times EBIT, as we talked about before. This is an extremely low valuation for growing cash flow positive tech companies, as we're going to show next. And we're targeting 1 times sales and 3 times gross profit for 110 upside in the name, even though that's still rather cheap for a company with both accelerating revenue growth and rising margins. So to sanity check our thinking, we ran a screen for U.S. tech companies that were cash flow positive and growing both sales and gross profit in their most recent reported period. There were 130 of them. On the list, only one was below 2 times gross profit, only 6 were below 2.5 times gross profit, and only 11 were below 3 times gross profit. The median was 8 times. Including PAR, there are only 4 were below 1 times sales, and the median even to sales level was 4.3 times. We looked a little closely at the outliers on the screen, the ones that were below 2 and 3, and most of them have some idiosyncratic flaws that technically put them on the screen, but they probably shouldn't have been. So for instance, a couple had recently made an acquisition to boost their revenues and gross profits. One had really lumpy cash flow that was positive in 2016, but was forecasted to burn in 2017. Some are from conglomerates. But the upshot is, if you're a normal, growing, profitable tech company, 0.25 times sales and 1 times gross profit is just way too cheap. Zooming in a little bit in the tech landscape to PAR's closest comps, we're looking at Agilisys, which is similar to PAR, except it sells to the hotel hospitality POS industry, similar to PAR's Springer Miller business before they divested it. And then Postera, which is a Canada nanocap, it's in the restaurant POS business like PAR. In our mind, both of these companies have significant problems and are less investable than PAR. For instance, Agilisys' CEO and CFO both abruptly left recently, and the company recently had to state they would be intensifying their cash burn but couldn't quantify it. Postera is also burning cash as well, is subscale, and has very low revenue growth. We believe the management there is also mediocre at best, potentially weak. We've spoken to a few previous and current owners of the stock, and were unsuccessful despite reaching out multiple times to get a hold of their management team. We think in a bearish case for PAR, it would be to trade at about 2 times their recurring revenue base, which is roughly 2 times gross profit, and that would put it a bit above Postera, but materially below Agilisys. In this case, PAR is over 40% upside, and just getting in line with Agilisys, PAR is closer to 95% upside. We'd also like to point out 2 major transaction comps, which we've alluded to in the previous to the presentation. So in August of 2011, NCR acquired Radiant Systems, and in September, Oracle acquired Micros. And you can see just from the multiples, you know, 3x sales, 8 to 10 times recurring, about seven times gross profit, about 20x EBITDA for both of those companies. And we're fully cognizant that those are takeout multiples, that both Micros and Radiant have significantly more scale and liquidity, and they have better mix of revenue, like higher recurring revenue. But we think it's instructive to think about PAR as it continues to build its recurring revenue base and more closely resembles the profile of both Micros and Radiant. Those two companies had about 40% of the revenues listed as recurring, while PAR is closer to 25%. But we think over the next few years, that gap could close materially. And we did add this one more slide, perhaps at my own peril for being a little bit too precise. But we try to take each piece of the business and assign it a sales multiple to justify our target of 1x overall sales. We don't think any of these multiples listed here are very demanding. We could certainly argue that Brink should trade at closer to 10x 2017 revenues, given its growth trajectory and visibility. 1.25x multiple for hardware recurring revenue also seems pretty harsh, given it's pretty consistent and growing with decent margins. SureCheck is really the only outlier that could make it, that could be materially less. We have it about, valued at about $18 million, 3x sales. But from our perspective, there's such a wide range of outcomes for SureCheck that we're willing to do a little bit of probability adjusting to raise the valuation there.
Yeah, so kind of winding down here and wrapping it up a little bit, it's hard to discuss a micro cap like this without touching on management. So I think the first point we would make is that Karen Simon is CEO. She is the founder's daughter. So this sort of incites the raises eyebrows and incites the calls of nepotism. There were two other CEOs that PAR had since the founder, John Salmon. John Salmon Sr. stepped down, and that didn't work out very well. We've met with Karen several times. She effectively owns 30% of the company as part of a family partnership. And she's made some pretty smart and tough decisions even before getting named CEO. So, for example, she was instrumental in the sale of Springer Miller, and was the driving force behind acquiring Brink, which turned out to be a great decision. There's a new CFO just announced, Brian Minar, long tenure as a Goldman Sachs partner. No strong opinion here yet, but just the fact that they've gotten a CFO after not having one for 9 months is, in my mind, an incremental positive, just as that uncertainty is removed. And then the board of directors, it's an entirely new regime, mostly all new fresh faces. 5 of 7 board members have been there less than 2 years. Only the co-founder has been there longer than 5. Two strong board members to point out, Cynthia Russo, previously CFO at Micros and Cvent. They were both acquired. And then Todd Tyler at another software firm that was acquired by Vista Private Equity that focuses only on software companies. And then Paul Rubin, very important, Senior VP of Engineering and Product Development. I've got more resources at his disposal now that the R&D teams and resources of Pixelpoint and Brink have been merged. And he's definitely kind of the industry key opinion leader in all of cloud-based POS. Summing up the various segments here with a quick sum of the parts, we've got government business at 7x EBIT, less $5 million in taxes. The hospitality business that John just broke down on a line-by-line basis at 1x sales, no net cash. They own their headquarters. It's a building where I don't really put much value on that. I don't think they'll sell it or anything. And they've got a $4 million receivable that's coming from Constellation Software by June of this year, another $4.5 million or so. So adding all of that up, we get about 105% upside from today's closing price. So it's really an asymmetric bet to the upside, a lot of optionality, a lot of meat on the bone, a lot of revenue for such a company of such small size. But this investment is not without its risk. I would say first and foremost would just be liquidity. Might be too small for some of the really large institutions out there. We were lucky to pick up a lot of big blocks. So there's some, you know, that every now and then there's a couple days with massive liquidity. They had issues with the previous CFO, rather. So cockroach theory would dictate that there's potentially even more problems there. They've hired outside consultants and auditors. They had an issue where the previous CFO had made some unauthorized investments. Those have since been written down. There were some lingering effects that lasted a couple of quarters. Hopefully that's all behind them at this point. In addition, they announced weak internal controls in the China and Singapore offices. We think this was more qualitative in nature and had to do with paperwork on some importing paperwork, and only affects about $4 million of the sales. Other risk are the hardware margins eroding long-term, Brink rollout misses, and management loses credibility. Competition intensifies. Everybody in VC land seems to not care about making money, so they can do crazy things. A lot of customer concentration in McDonald's. And then I'd say another major risk would be what they do with the capital allocation policy and the cash after the windfall of the government sale. With that, I will flip it back to Shai and see if we have any time for Q&A.
Yeah, Travis and John, that was terrific. This is a particularly interesting idea, in my opinion. And I've spent some time studying Agilisys in the previous life, so this hits close to home. I have 16 questions, which I'd like to go through if time allows. But we'll see how we do. Let's go to slide 15, please. And we'll try to go chronologically to keep it simple.
Yes.
So there's clearly going to be a pro forma net cash balance, which is roughly half the market cap. In the case of Agilisys, most of the cash was earmarked for product revitalization as opposed to dividend or buyback. I'm wondering if there's any way to forecast where the cash might go in this case, and if it's appropriate to take this to purely assume its excess.
Yeah, I'll take a stab first and John can fill in details. We will push for at least some return of cash to throw sort of long-suffering investors a bone. So I would personally push for a special dividend. I do think almost all of that cash would, in its entirety, would be excess, as the pro forma hospitality business will remain profitable and cash flow positive. But that being said, our feeling is that they're going to look for a consumer-facing technology that is SaaS-based as a potential tuck-in acquisition. So our understanding is their criteria is that acquisition target must have sort of tier one customers that overlap with their existing or targeted customer base, have substantial revenue, and then be accretive to bottom line within 2 years. That's sort of how I would say that, but it's certainly a risk. It'll be an ongoing discussion with management, and hopefully we'll get more disclosures around that ahead of the divestiture, and then if not, especially after. John, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I would just say they'll probably keep some cash just to grow their cash balance because it's a little bit low right now and become more like a traditional tech company that has a little extra cash to throw around. But it just as Travis said, yeah, we're going to push pretty hard for a special dividend. We think some of the other shareholders would prefer that, but we think they also do want to make a couple tuck-in acquisitions. We don't think they have like a plan to make a gigantic acquisition, but that would be the biggest risk of a large value destructive acquisition.
And I guess asking a similar question along similar lines, if Agilisys has just spent many million dollars on their POS platform, how do we compare how Brink and Agilisys' platform perform side by side?
John, you want to answer?
Well, I mean, they're different markets. So Agilisys is going after the hotel market. And, Brink is specifically going after the QSR restaurant market. So, I guess I'm not sure how relevant it is to compare.
A couple of dozen conversations, I'd say Agilisys has never come up once with anyone in the industry. So I guess that'd be a differentiating factor. I think one key thing, though, just to reemphasize in terms of Brink is and that it was sort of built for enterprise-level deployment from day one and then built for the cloud from day one. So they've already got the core infrastructure in place, where it sounds like you're alluding to Agilisys is sort of playing catch up on that front.
No, that's fair. And then if we go to slide 20.
Yeah, when I was reading Agilisys' conference call, that's kind of the impression I got, is they didn't seem quite ready to launch the bigger implementations, and that's where the cash burn was going to come from. Whereas, as Travis just mentioned, Brink was specifically designed to start with large implementations, even though they had to start with smaller customers. The design of the software was meant to accommodate larger customers.
And part of that is smaller players are quicker to adopt the new technology, and the larger guys are slow.
That's very fair. That makes a lot of sense. Can we turn the slide to 20, please?
Yeah. This one?
Yeah, and I'm curious, is there a sense of build versus buy at an HR level? Would it make more sense to poach key employees as opposed to buying the entire operation outright?
Well, they've got
That's a good question. They've got
3 to 5 year contracts at the entity level. So if a key, you know, it's all just coders, and it's all coders, and then on the one side it's the PhD coders that aren't on the biz dev side. They could definitely poach it in the more the business development, the executive side. But
I don't actually have knowledge of this, Travis. But I'd be shocked if there weren't non-compete agreements in the contracts. That's pretty standard. That's something we could follow up on. So if you're poaching them, you might have to wait 2 years to get them.
And it basically you would see the backlog drop off a cliff also, and it just wouldn't replenish. We haven't seen a sign of that yet, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
And if we turn to slide 24, please. I noticed that PAR is a customer for many of these tier one restaurants. I'm wondering if it's commonplace to dual source. Perhaps there's another peer who's also a customer as well. Just commenting on.
Yeah, taking McDonald's, for example, McDonald's has 2 approved POS, the hardware terminal vendors, which would be PAR and Panasonic. We're not quite sure of the mix between the two. So we think most of the tier one guys will at least have a minimum of 2 suppliers, just in case they have to play off of each other if one goes down or whatnot. For example, on this, and this is only showing hardware, but I know for a fact Arby's has 37 different POS vendors, but they are going through these pilot programs with the cloud players in order to consolidate that and sort of get it to a more manageable level. So the answer is yes, definitely a lot of POS providers within these tier ones. They would like to have a fewer number. Yeah.
It's usually how it works is at a corporate level they approve 2 vendors. We'll say 1 to 3 vendors, and that's basically a hunting license for PAR to go out and try to sign the franchisees to deals. But usually it's not like a free for all where there's like 10 vendors for each restaurant chain. It's usually like 2.
And I guess asking a similar question, is revenue growth by definition zero sum, or is there actually a growing adoption curve?
There's a growing adoption curve as a shift from on-premise to cloud. So that, I would say, is an inning number 1. So while everybody has a POS system in place, it's just not a cloud-based deployment. So the only other growth would be just unit count growth in the QSR or fast casual and restaurant space overall. I'm sure that might be, you know, around GDP level growth.
If we could turn to slide 26, please. I think this is really phenomenal data, which I haven't seen anywhere else. I'm curious how you got this data. Or any thoughts about how other people could gain similar insights?
John?
This is actually just a conversation with their IR representative. contact Chris from IR. and ask him how a typical agreement works, and he'll kind of walk through how this works. He was only willing to do it with us for McDonald's. I'm not sure why that is, but I think it's a pretty good McDonald's is probably a little bigger than their average customer, so like maybe the average customer has more like 4 or 5 terminals. But I think directionally it gives you an idea of how a hardware franchise works, and they were pretty open about that.
If we could turn to slide 27, please. I'm wondering if there's any how international franchisees factor in, if there's international vendors, if a possible offshore supplier could penetrate the U.S. market. How do we think about non-USA growth and non-USA suppliers?
Mm-hmm. It's actually my understanding is it's actually a bi-country thing, and PAR has significant, almost dominant penetration in many countries, and then a lot less penetration in other countries. So, for instance, they do very well in China, I believe, because China McDonald's has recommended them. But other countries they may not do as well. But I think how it works is every country does have a way of announcing who their preferred vendors are. But for the most part, it's always for McDonald's at least, it's all Panasonic and PAR. I think maybe a couple countries use NCR, but does that make sense? Did I kind of answer the question? It seems unlikely to me that there'd be international competition coming into the U.S. There could be more international competition. There definitely could be more international competition internationally. So
I guess my concern,
most of the value that we have in PAR is not dependent on their international ambitions. That would be more upside if they're able to penetrate those areas further.
I guess my concern would be if a lot of Yum's growth is coming from Asia, could the supplier to Asia end up also supplying America eventually? I guess could the supplier overseas migrate into the United States?
Yeah, that's possible. I guess I would only refer you to the fact that they've done business with Yum for 35 years consecutively. I think it's about 35. It was, I believe, the second major customer they signed back in the 80s. And as far as I know, there's testimonials on YouTube that show how happy Yum customers are implementing PAR. Take that for what it's worth. But I would say it's like a small risk, but it doesn't strike me, and Travis, you can add if you want, but given the long history they had with these vendors, it doesn't strike me as a huge risk.
And then if we could turn to slide 31, please. I believe you mentioned Baskin-Robbins in the audio as we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if the economics of Baskin-Robbins for a cloud-based client are similar to other I'm wondering if the Baskin-Robbins price point and lifespan compares to legacy clients and price points, just comparing the Baskin-Robbins math on legacy math somehow.
Oh, so what is Pixel Point revenue or ARPU for on-premise versus the new Brink sales? John, do you know that?
They really don't disclose the revenue levels specifically within Pixel Point. I think it's safe to assume the economics are worse because some of them aren't even paying maintenance, is my understanding. So I guess one challenge of converting them might be to having to convince them that the total cost of ownership for Baskin-Robbins would need to be higher because they're going to go on a SaaS-based model. But yeah, my understanding is the economics are worse for Pixel Point in general because they kind of botched how they pitched it. They basically sold licenses and then in some cases didn't sell maintenance or didn't like make maintenance a priority, which is sort of the lifeblood of most software companies. So I think that, you know,
also it's still,
that could be a messy transition at some point, but it's not really a huge part of the thesis.
Yeah, also it's sold purely through a value add reseller channel, and then it's doing about 6 million a year in licenses. But we do know, even outside of Baskin Robbins, I think there's an international product called Heritage, which has some other tier ones internationally on Pixel Point. So if anything, we just view that as another potential pool of customers that they can ultimately transition to Brink. But the answer is slightly worse economic.
So Baskin Robbins is using Pixel Point, not using Brink. That's correct?
Right.
Okay. Right. Right. That's the one large identified customer that we know of for Pixel Point.
I think Popeyes also maybe internationally.
And I've been trying to figure out where ShopKeep and Lavvu would fit into the picture. Would ShopKeep and Lavvu be Pixel Point peers?
Not familiar with those, are you, John?
ShopKeep?
Correct.
I'm actually not familiar with ShopKeep. I believe that's would be like the equivalent of a Rebel, like an ankle biter, but I'd have to follow up on that. They're iOS based, I believe, ShopKeep.
I believe so, correct. So we could move on. Just trying to figure out if it's relevant to the thesis or if it's a whole tangential rabbit hole.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, they are I have heard of them. They're just not the ones that come up most frequently as competitors. So I think they'd be similar to a Revel, I think, like a lower end, looking for smaller deployments. They probably say they can do enterprise, but I suspect that they're similar to Revel as they struggle with when implementations get larger.
Sure, and then moving to slide 34, please. I believe you mentioned that there was a conference you attended. If you could please elaborate what this conference was and just what you learned being on the ground.
Yeah. It was the Food Service Technology Conference in Dallas in 2016. Really enlightening. We basically went with the one goal of doing boots on the ground scuttlebutt as it pertains to PAR. So all of the major POS vendors that we're discussing were there with sales booths, and we just walked around and played dumb and grilled them and got product demos and asked a lot of independent third parties who had no idea what our goal was, what they thought of the space, what they thought of Brink, attended, you know, the panels when these a lot of attendees were information technology personnel for their big restaurant chains or the chief information officers sort of for these larger restaurant chains. So just a lot of, you know, good commentary around the space in general. Paul Rubin was sort of the keynote speaker in one of the presentations, talking about the history of point of sale. And so really got a lot of incremental data points and just comfort around talking to a couple dozen people there. So we talked to some of the people that were private equity operators, who, again, we sort of got some new contacts and had multiple follow-up calls with them, and then that led to other calls, just sort of doing channel checks of opinions about Brink. So very helpful, very great use of time. And definitely recommend, it's one of our goals this year. In fact, we're going to an auto conference, a non-Wall Street sponsored, or our goal this year is to go to a lot more non-sort of Wall Street sponsored industry conferences. Definitely one of the best uses of time to learn about an industry or a company.
And if we could move to slide 35, please. I think we touched on this a bit earlier, but I'm trying to figure out who is losing market share as Brink's is growing at such a rapid clip. Or maybe it maybe
it's a good question. Many of these are. You know, most restaurants have some kind of POS, all restaurants have some kind of POS, right? So the displacement that's occurring is displacing the on-site POS system with a cloud-based POS system. And from my understanding, some of the displacements are actually like failed implementations of Revel and Toast that, you know, Paul Rubin talked about one example of like a 400 to 500 unit store that tried to implement on Revel and couldn't, and then went over to Brink. And then the rest of it's displacement from just very old legacy on-site platforms. So that, I mean, that could be, you know, there's dozens of them. Some of them are probably getting, you know, from the big guys like Oracle and Micros, but there's also a lot of, as Travis was mentioning, like Arby's supports 37 different POS systems, some of them going back like 10, 15 years, and they're just kind of like on last minute support. So I think there's a lot of just old POS systems that are getting swapped out with new cloud-based systems.
In some cases, they're at the larger chains, they're internally developed, like the McDonald's. So,
and if we some of them do their own. Some of them do their own POS.
And then moving to slide 38, please. Could you explain what attachment rate for hardware means? I'm not sure what that phrase. Sorry for
that. Right. That is confusing. Kind of rushed through that. felt like we were running out of time. So if a customer buys Brink software, they also offer them the hardware, right? And what we've been told is that 80% of Brink software customers also purchase hardware. So 20% don't. Like, I think Pita Pit is one example of one that did not purchase the hardware with the software, but 80% of the time thus far, they not only purchase Brink software, they also buy the hardware, and then that comes with hardware maintenance contracts and services and other implementation services. Does that make sense?
Yeah, terrific. Thank you. And if we could move to slide 39, please.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious who the ARPU of 160 to 170. I'm curious how much the range is across the industry. If there's a sense of the bell and whistles are 200 and the lowest price point is 100. How do we look at the industry pricing and who's the price leader? Just the ARPU across the board, or how can we start to understand ARPU across the board? If there's any way to get a sense of this question or this area.
I can speak to the ARPU for PAR more. John may be able to speak to it more across the industry. But I believe, 150 is the existing rate now, but it is quickly rising as they're starting to upsell and tack on more modules like mobile ordering or a loyalty program. So I think the base rate, if you say you have, John, correct me if I'm wrong, two POS terminals, you would pay $100, you would pay $50 in support, and then you would pay $50 extra per module that's tacked on. And then if you buy more than two terminals, the dollar value per terminal, the service per terminal comes down, so it might scale down as you get more units. Secondly, there's a big discrepancy between if they're selling through a third party with an ARPU of sub 150 versus selling direct, which would be in the range of 200 to 220 per store. So the mix shift of sales is quickly shifting to more direct at the higher ARPU. But John, can you speak at all to how they rank up against the competition?
I can't speak, well, not exactly, unfortunately. We do know that, you know, as you might expect, Oracle and NCR are more expensive, but it's hard to do an exact apples to apples comparison, mostly because there's very few cloud Oracle and NCR implementations at this point. In fact, there's almost none. So until some of those implementations actually occur, and we get a better idea of what the pricing is, It's a little bit hard to compare the SaaS model versus the on-premise model that Oracle and NCR would do. My understanding for like the smaller players like Revel and Toast, I don't have the exact average price, but they are cheaper. So Brink is somewhere in the middle. Brink is somewhere in the middle. They're more expensive than the Revels and Toast little startup companies, but less expensive than NCR and Oracle. But it'll bear watching as Oracle and NCR, if they ever do get traction with their in the restaurant business with their cloud products. Right now, I think they're selling cloud products to other industries like retail and not having much success in restaurants yet. It seems like Brink is actually beating them for the most part. But my understanding is they'd be a little more expensive. And the other thing to think about is they really want to push for customizations to the software so they can generate, like the big guys, Oracle and NCR, want to push for customizations to the software so they can charge, first of all, they can lock you in. And second of all, they can charge extra, professional services fees to work on those customizations. So Brink is a little more out of the box, less customization, ready to go versus those other two big ones, if that makes sense. So I think naturally the two bigger players are going to be more expensive because they're going to push customization or like recommend customizations, but also just because they're generally more expensive. Because they're the biggest players.
I want to make this clear, though. Brink is customizable. So, in other words, you can have, obviously, pricing and menu differences on a store-by-store basis or a regional basis. You can push those down at any time, keep track of it, and you can have any sort of combination between the stores.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my goal from that point of view. It's just a more open
there's a certain
platform in terms of playing nice with the third-party vendors, like the accounting software, like CrunchTime or something.
Right.
And just to clarify,
right, exactly.
This is a monthly number, so $160 per month. Is that correct?
Yes, $160 per month per store.
So there seems to be some pricing power if it's mission critical. How often do they negotiate pricing?
It's month to month, but some customers have requested long-term pricing clarity. And in this case, my understanding is that they signed a couple of these longer-term contracts, and then they'll have a price adjustment upward tied to an inflation index for the most part.
If there's not that longer-term understanding, then Brink is technically able to raise prices whenever they want to. But, I guess they'd probably be judicious about that.
Have we seen any pricing power in the past?
It's just a little too early. Yeah.
You are seeing it right now a little bit, though, just with that ARPU. Again, more of it's the mixed shift of the sales going direct and the module upselling, but you're going to see it rise just through that. I'm not sure how much is through pure pricing power at this point.
If we could turn to slide 50.
Yeah, that's something that we'd like to investigate more a little bit. Frankly, it's just impossible to tell. They're going to sell different modules like loyalty card management and kitchen management, so that's a way to increase it. They're going to go up chain, so they're going to sell to bigger organizations with more terminals, so that should increase it. There'll probably be, as you mentioned, there'll be some increases, from inflation. So there's different ways to raise it. The last thing I heard was that they are comfortable with a long-term target of $190 to $200 blended ARPU.
Does Brink's own the data, so it's very difficult to migrate if you try to leave?
Brink advertises that it's very easy to leave as part of their strategy to be like kind of the anti-lock-in vendor. Go ahead.
The inverse is that Brink is very good at migrating data from a previous POS system for a restaurant chain onto their platform. So it sounded like, or we heard that it's easier to migrate from Aloha, which is the Radiant System POS, to Brink rather than Aloha, from Aloha to NCR's Silver platform.
Silver.
Just because it plays so much better. So the inverse to your question is, Brink makes it easy to switch onto their platform, easy to get off as well. But again, we've heard anywhere from estimates of between 1% to 2% churn, and not losing this for competitive reasons.
Sure. And then moving to slide 53, please, or 54, please.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to ask more about the five board members who are new, if there's any pattern among these five, and a bit of clarity why there's been so much churn at the board level recently.
Frankly, I mean, it was just because of, new leadership was desired by the founder and the daughter, Karen. And once they got rid of the previous CEO, Ronald Cassiano, I believe there was some more significant turnover. And then I think Karen then selected or, kind of recruited a couple of these new people, like Cynthia Russo, the former CFO at Micros, and then Todd Tyler. But, I mean, I think a lot of it was just the company had failed on its strategy, and the board was seen as a failure. And my impression is that John Salmon, the founder, who's 78 years old, kind of wanted wholesale changes. I don't have on me the exact, timeline of exactly who was left and when. There's been quite a bit of movement. And I think it's also been from lead, we've talked to some of the heaviest shareholders, like the people who own like 5 to 10% of the company, and they were just completely fed up. And I think them voicing their displeasure year after year, at some point there was kind of the final straw and they started to clean house.
And I guess following up or going one step further, have there been changes in the incentive structure? Perhaps there's a different bonus compensation or any other indication of possible change of control provision or anything else that you've stumbled across?
I think I'm aware of.
We do look at that or emphasize that usually, but not that we're aware of.
And as a very final question, I'd love to ask you just to share more on the Voss sauce, how the Voss sauce came about, if this is a new thing or it's been evolving over time, just any context of what you discovered and how you discovered it, please.
I think we just looked back. I'll let John elaborate, but really it was looking back at our biggest winners over time. And what constituted, why did they play out with that word way? Kind of doing a post-mortem, what we noticed is that a company sells an asset, slims down, becomes an asset, becomes a pure play, and then is showing accelerating growth and expanding margins simultaneously. You really get the multiplier effect. It's psychologically pleasing to investors. It attracts new growth investors for a reason. Maybe they're extrapolating that trend. It does. It is a sign of positive fundamental developments. John, do you have anything to add?
Well, I would just say that from a value perspective, it can work even if it goes from negative growth to positive growth, which is usually what, growth investors aren't really looking at that. But if it goes from like negative 1% to positive 5%, suddenly the whole perception of the company changes. And usually if it's negative 1% growth, it's going to trade at a very depressed multiple. But now if we're at a 5% growth rate and expanding margins, which is often possible, once you've divested an asset, when you divest the asset initially, it screens more poorly because, revenue growth looks lower and there's often some like severance costs, so profitability gets hit. So then in a way, it's kind of like an easy comp as it comes around, like a few quarters after the divestiture and some of the severance packages. And so, at the very minimum, optically, it's going to start looking a lot better to people and potentially re-rates. Now, we try to find ones that don't just have that quality, but have things like PAR where they have hidden assets that are growing triple digits also to kind of cap things off and that are also profitable. But that's, you know, we've had several examples now where either it worked really well, or even if it didn't work, you didn't really lose money. So it's more of those, you know, there's margin of safety in some of those examples when the valuation is so depressed and they've just made a divestiture to clean themselves up.
Yeah, terrific. And how could viewers best reach you? Email, website, what do you suggest?
Yeah, either or, vosscap.com. My email is t@vosscap.com, just the letter T. And then John is J-O-N, John at VossCap, VossCap.com. I can throw it up on the screen. Yeah, any other questions, Shai?
No, I just want to thank you so much for both sharing a great idea and also teaching us how you see the world. It's great to have both, and very much appreciate your time and very grateful for such a terrific terrific idea. So John, J-O-N at VossCap, V-O-S-S-C-A-P, Travis
yeah.
at VossCap. Please reach out with any questions, and thank you so much for being here. Have a great night.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, bye-bye.